whole narrative that says everything is going down is much easier to sell than a narrative that says, well, actually, that's not exactly true, that like some places are improving and some places are becoming worse.
Welcome to Inside Biodiversity. This podcast is hosted by IDIV, the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research. My name is Volker Hahn. I'm head of the communications unit at IDIV. In today's episode, we will focus on a question which is at the core of biodiversity research. How is biodiversity changing? My guest is Maria Dornelas. Maria is a professor at the University of St. Andrews in the United Kingdom and at the University of Lisbon in Portugal. Her work has challenged some of the prevailing views about biodiversity change. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here.
Let's start off by you telling us briefly who you are and why do you research biodiversity change?
So I am a macroecologist, and about 10 years ago, we started assembling a database of biodiversity time series called Biotime. And then we started extracting trends from that database. And much to our surprise, when we first started doing it, I very much thought that I was going to be talking about losing mammals faster than we're losing plants or something to that, similar to that. And instead, what we found is that the biodiversity, temporal trends in biodiversity are much more complex than I was anticipating. And there's, rather than finding systematic loss everywhere, we see mixed trends with some increases, some decreases, and some remarkably stable trends in the numbers of species that we see in any one place. It took us maybe 2 years to actually trust those results and publishing them. And when they were published, they were fairly controversial. I would say that they've held pretty well, and it's now been 10 years, and I don't think very willing to be persuaded otherwise, but I don't think anyone has shown that we were wrong in that pattern. So it's just turned out to be much more variable than we thought it was going to be in terms of the numbers of species that we see in any one place. But at the same time, what we also found is that there is really extraordinary change in the identities of the species that we find in any one place. And so like one of my hobby horses at the moment is that I really think that we should be talking about biodiversity change rather than just talking about biodiversity loss.
Your work is cited a lot in the context of what is called the biodiversity conservation paradox. Can you explain to us what that paradox is and why it's paradox, what is paradoxical about it?
Well, the paradox comes from like the realization that humans have undoubtedly changed the planet in really substantial ways. And we know that a lot of what we do to this planet, from, you know, climate change and land use change and different extraction activities, is typically not great for biodiversity, quite frankly. And so how do you then reconcile that knowledge with also the observation that at least since we started seriously monitoring biodiversity, we don't detect declines everywhere? I'm also puzzled by this. I think I don't have an answer to, and I think from a purely scientific point of view, then that's kind of cool because it means there's more questions to ask and more things to understand. But my personal bias is that I also care a lot about the environment and I care a lot about biodiversity, so much so that I've devoted my life to studying it. And so I definitely don't want to be misinterpreted as the person who said everything is fine and there is no biodiversity crisis. That is very much not what I'm saying. Just to be clear, like in addition to the macroecology side of my work, I also do field work, and my field work is on coral reefs, which are kind of like the poster child for an ecosystem that's not doing great, especially with the marine heat waves that keep causing huge mass mortalities. And so just to be clear, like my personal experience, like the data set that I've collected, I have witnessed long-term study site having an event where we had 98% mortality. And that's, you know, really sad. Like, I have a very strong emotional response to this, a very strong emotional attachment to these places. And so, like, do not want to downplay biodiversity loss where it happens. The thing is, that's not the only thing that happens. We also see often remarkable paths of recovery. And the other thing that is that we've increasingly realized is that biodiversity change is incredibly scale dependent, for example. So you can have sort of losses at one scale and gains at another. Also, like, the key to this, I think, is actually related to the compositional change that we're witnessing. So we often have replacement of species, and that's a much stronger signal than just the loss of species or just the gain of species.
So I wonder, I mean, you also said you are puzzled and you don't know really what the drivers are that explain what you're observing. I wonder, in an undisturbed habitat, would there also be this species turnover, so that the identity of the species changes, but the overall number might remain the same? And do we know, if that's the case, how much have humans changed that process? Have we accelerated this so-called temporal species turnover?
Well, I'll start by saying that I think currently there are no undisturbed places on the planet, right? We have, like, seriously, seriously changed it. So even in a deep ocean, you can find plastics. And, you know, because we've done climate change to the planet, even where you don't have humans physically going to, I think we currently have an undisturbed place on the planet. So that's, like, kind of sidestepping your question a little bit.
Makes it harder to see what is the effect of humans.
Okay. Exactly. It's not obvious, is it? Mm-hmm. So to think carefully about the effect of humans on the planet, then we have to use much longer timescales than we have just normal biodiversity, like modern biodiversity monitoring for, because increasingly clear that human modifications of the planet are much older than we thought. This work coming from Earl Ellis that shows that as far back as 12,000 years ago, there's really prevalent land use change in many parts of the world. There's also evidence that land use change has not been unidirectional, right? So there's, like, sometimes we clear-cut forests. Other times you have sort of farmland abandonment and you have forests grow back. So this idea that we have that we've only changed the planet in one direction, I think, is also part of why we see this variability and this complexity in biodiversity trends. What I really wanted to point out is that I think we need to use sort of longer timescales, and we need to tap into our paleo colleagues to do that. And then it becomes challenging because the types of data that you have are so different, but also really interesting. And in terms of figuring out how have rates changed in the history of life, not just the very recent past, but, like, more broadly, and what is natural and not natural.
So it's yet not possible to disentangle that so far.
Well, I'm excited about work that's being done in this area. I think it's an open question. I think there are exciting things coming, including from work groups here at IDF. So,
you said that your study was picked up by your fellow researchers as, well, it was controversial. Can you tell us more about the reactions to your study and why was it so surprising? How did they react?
I mean, it was definitely controversial, I would say. But I think reactions were mixed, with some people suddenly going, oh, I actually see that pattern in my own data, and I thought I was weird. So thank you for it. So there was one element of people suddenly recognizing their pattern, the pattern that they've seen in their own data, as being part of a bigger pattern of change more than just loss. There were other people whose reaction was like, if you say that, then you're undermining the conservation movement because you're sort of making the point that there is no biodiversity crisis. And again, I want to say very clearly that it's not, like, I never said that there was no change in biodiversity, only that change in biodiversity is sometimes losses, sometimes gains. I've increasingly started questioning, partly from looking at work that other colleagues are doing on invasive species, for example, are all biodiversity gains good and are all biodiversity losses bad? Increasingly, my position is that good and bad are value judgments, and they're very much not my area of expertise because I'm an ecologist, and good and bad, I think, are in a realm of psychology and sociology, and, you know, good and bad for whom becomes the question as well. And again, I think there's probably complexity there as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That, I think that's highly interesting and leads me to a different question. When we talk about this, what is the best term we should use for when we talk about what's going on in the world with biodiversity? Is it a crisis? Is it a Armageddon? Is it just change? What is a good word to use?
This will probably make me really unpopular, but I think the most accurate description of current biodiversity change is actually nuanced and complex, which I know is a challenge from the point of view of communication, especially when there is like a sense of urgency, and we know that the pace of change of the planet is increasing. And so a simple narrative that says everything is going down is much easier to sell than a narrative that says, well, actually, that's not exactly true, that like some places are improving and some places are becoming worse. Or at least that's what I thought initially. One thing that I am increasingly aware of as well is that actually the conservation movement has matured. I like this kind of very almost silly example. So when I was a teenager, being an environmentalist and having sort of an eco-conscious was made me kind of weird. There was not very common. And when my kids started nursery, they had to take turns at being the eco person in the room because it was such a popular thing to do. And so the conservation movement has really made huge progress. And maybe because I'm an optimist, sometimes I think that at least part of this signal that we don't have losses everywhere is actually coming from there. So we have changed things. Like we've started managing fisheries differently. We started managing in Europe, for example, like many EU regulations have been enforced that have made clear impact on water quality, on, you know, protecting habitats. Like we've expanded protected areas massively. We're not done, right? There's a lot more to be done, but I'm hopeful that at least part of this nuanced change in biodiversity is coming from the places where we've done better than we have done in the past. And I wonder if we don't talk enough about the successes of better management of biodiversity and better management of this planet. So I don't think necessarily that the narrative that everything is getting worse is, I don't think it's truthful. And then I don't think necessarily that it is, it might be simpler, but I don't think it's necessarily better. I actually think that a narrative of hope is also important and potentially effective, potentially more effective. And I wonder if, like, one of the things that the biodiversity world needs to do is to look at what's happened to climate change and not repeat the same errors, right? So there's been like this shift in the climate.
Can we talk about climate change
yeah.
a bit later? I think that's okay. That's very interesting. But I think you've made it very clear that you're not saying, and your research doesn't show, that there's nothing to worry about. Instead, it's nuance, as you say, and it depends on where exactly are you
looking
yeah. right? So really just looking at the average, what is happening may not be that helpful.
Agreed. I think we need to look at the variability in trends. And I think that's potentially really useful because then it also helps us create priorities, right? We can't do everything. What should we be focusing on? And then, you know, there'll be different strategies for what to focus on. And we can think about sort of proactive versus reactive strategies, where the proactive ones are the ones that identify the places that are doing great and then prioritize those as the things that we want to maintain. Or you can have reactive strategies where you identify the places that are doing worse and prioritize improving those. And probably, you know, the smart thing to do is to do both, or to do, you have a strategy that has a combination of these two things. But focusing, I mean, the mean is an abstraction that doesn't actually exist. And to some extent, like what's happening on average is useful from a communication point of view. But is it though, right? Especially if the average is not super informative about, and the variance is much more so.
but there are some, you know, there were also some pushbacks and some people saying it can't be true. Or let's say more general, there were some criticisms on your study. What were they? What are the other like perspectives on this issue?
Yeah. Some of the criticisms are, I want to start by saying, actually quite valid. So one key criticism that often comes up is that, like, most of our temporal horizons are probably too short to include when many of the changes have happened.
So how long were the time series that you looked at?
So the database stretches from the late 1800s to the present, but really the overwhelming majority of the data is from the past, you know, 40 to 50 years. And my response to that is that we've seen an acceleration of rates of change in this period. And so in principle, you should be like, this is a period of time that we really care about. And also my other response is that we don't have a time machine. So to some extent, we're kind of stuck with the data that we have because until someone comes up with a time machine.
And another criticism was the so-called lifeboat effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other criticism that comes up is that like our data is incredibly biased in all kinds of ways, right? So it's taxonomically biased, it's spatially biased. We definitely don't have
it. So it's not representative.
It's not representative
of what is going on in the whole world.
And this becomes especially important once we become aware of the variability, right? So if we had homogeneous change, it wouldn't matter, right? Like whatever you sampled would be representative of. When you don't, when you have this variability, then, you know, it really matters where you have sampled, where you have and you haven't looked. And so, for example, I'm very keenly aware we don't have enough data from the polar regions. We don't have enough data from the tropics either. So that's one of the things. So some of the work that we've done since has been sort of focused on quantifying like the geography of biodiversity change. And there's definitely patterns there. So I think improving the representativeness of biodiversity monitoring is super important. And I think, I really think that this is where we need a global approach to this, because some of the places where we don't have observations are where we don't have wealth. So, you know, in poorer places and where you have fewer scientists, we have, those are blind spots. And then the other places where we don't have observations is where humans don't go, because it's too deep in the sea, for example, or because it's, you know, too cold or nighttime or whatever. So I really think we need a global approach to that if we want to end up with a more representative. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see that. And also the time to start doing this is 50 years ago, and the second best time is now.
Yeah. So to summarize that, how contested are these findings of yours? Does everyone agree by now that what you found 10 years ago, and of course more recently also you continued that work, is there a consensus or is it still very contested?
I don't know, you're asking the wrong person here. I haven't changed my mind. And just to be clear, my kids say that I'm like continuously the devil's advocate. I'm quite open to change my mind. And I've yet to see evidence to the contrary of what we found.
Okay. So we talked about climate and I interrupted you. What do you think have been the most blatant errors in climate communication?
Oh, that is a very loaded question.
Yeah, but try to make it short. What's going wrong in climate communication?
Okay, so there's a meme going around somewhere that says that, you know, here are the steps of climate change denial, right? So the first, it's not happening. Second, it's happening, but it's not us. Third, it's us, but there's nothing that can be done. And when you realize that, yes, there's stuff that can be done, it's too late. And so, like, the outcomes of all of these are, let's do nothing. So one of the things that I think we can do better in biodiversity communication is not fall into that trap. It is not too late. To take one example, we know and have known for a while now that extinction rates in the recent past are really high. So they're higher than they have been
on a global level.
Global scale. Yes. Extinction is global, yes. Right? So I talked about how biodiversity change is scale dependent. You can have global loss without having local loss, because there are so many species on the planet that they can just redistribute themselves, right? So that's one of the reasons why we think we see the patterns that we see. But at the global scale, although this is really difficult to estimate, but like as far as we know, extinction rates are elevated. So much so that for a while now, people have said they were potentially in the middle of a mass extinction. And this one is caused by human actions. It doesn't follow from that this mass extinction needs to happen. Just because, like, you have to keep the current extinction rates for a really long time to have actually lost.
Like thousands of years.
Yes. So it's not too late is I think one of the things that we can do better from the point of view of communicating on the topic of biodiversity change.
So be more optimistic, yes. Or it's, as Hans Rosling said, possibilistic.
I am definitely a possibilitist.
Okay, we're slowly coming to the end. I know you've talked about it, but could you please summarize the essence of what we know, what is going on with biodiversity on this planet, with a few sentences in plain language for, let's say, a public audience?
Biodiversity change is scale dependent. What is happening on the entire planet is not necessarily what is happening at any one place. And what I think we know now is that at the local scale, in any one place, there are divergent paths of biodiversity. So although we see change almost everywhere we look in terms of the identities of the species that we find, some places are net winners of this change, so they're gaining species. Some places are net losers in that they're losing species, and some places just have a constant number of species. I think maybe that's my summary.
Okay, great. We've talked about many different aspects of your work. What would you like your audience to remember in a week from now from this conversation?
Embrace new ones. Overly simple messages are possibly not true.
Very good. Thank you very much, Maria, for this very interesting conversation.
Thank you for listening to Inside Biodiversity. Make sure to follow us on LinkedIn, X, and your podcast app. For feedback, ideas, or questions, use hashtag Inside Biodiversity or write us an email at podcast@idiv.de.